The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The first thing we're going to talk about, paragraph one, the nature of reality. Okay? This has been the question of philosophers. What are we made of? What is the stuff of existence? Substance. What does substance literally mean? Substance. That which is lying beneath everything. That is what substance is. And so we want to know what the substance of life is. And the truth is, even this class is still only an aspect of what Judaism believes as this substance of life. Okay? But we are dealing with an essential substrata of reality. Okay? Of our own existence, of everything that we encounter in our life. So, the first thing you need to know is that creation is understood by Judaism as an act of divine thought. Okay? God creates the world by thinking about the world. Okay? That's the way we would say it, so to speak, right? Our language, which is part of this, right? Trying to say this class, you really need to know this class in order to understand this class. That's the problem with the class, okay? In other words, the rules of understanding the class is what we're really trying to set down here, and so you have to be very patient. So in the meantime, the way we would say it is that God creates the world, reality, existence, which is basically broken up in Jewish thought in three categories. Time, space, and being. Okay? Zman, Olam, Venefesh. That's the way we would categorize everything that's in existence falls under the category of either time, space, or being. And all being is somehow defined in terms of time and space. So then, if creation is, so to speak, an act of divine thought, we come to existence through God thinking of us, so to speak. The table comes to existence by God, so to speak, thinking of the table. So then from the standpoint of physics, as the physicist explores reality and tries to figure out what everything's made of, okay, so what is everything made of? Based on what we've just presented, everything is made of thought. Everything is idea. The substance of existence, time, space, and being, the stuff they are made of is idea. Okay? Thought. So, at this point in science, they are comfortable. I mean, initially, they thought, well, you know, maybe it's made of these indestructible balls called atoms. Okay, and that's not so long ago, because that's kind of what I learned when I was in, you know, when I was in high school. But then they're moving, and they, you know, and they're moving, and so now we're at a point scientifically that they've now decided that it's all energy. There is no new energy, there is no old energy, and I can somehow describe reality with my mind and objectively observe reality and study the nature of reality. That's the way it is. And the substance is energy. Alright? I'm not saying that Judaism denies that. That's certainly, we've peeled away and we've really come to a substrata. But as science continues to peel, what I believe it will ultimately discover, okay, is that all is made of idea. Okay? That all is in fact made of thought. And all of a sudden science will discover the subjective quality to exploring reality. All right? And that's why yesterday I quoted to you John Wheeler, who said, is it possible that the world is coming into existence because we are questioning it and probing it? Our very desire to understand it is creating it. Alright? And then we're going to have to get into all kinds of issues. To what extent does the mind of the scientist influence what he is seeing? Okay? And this is what's starting to happen in science. But from the Kabbalistic point of view, right, in a Midrashic point of view, we talk about that the Kishe'ala b'machshavat Hashem, when God in His mind decided to create the world, that is already the beginning of creation, therefore that's the substrata of, that's the substance of creation. Time, space, and being are made of idea, okay, and exists within the divine mind. A primordial, original reality, mind, okay? And within that mind, created is time, space, and being, whose nature and substance is idea. That's the nature of reality. What then does that mean about ourselves? That means that He is the thinker, we are the thought. Right? That's the nature of our relationship to God. All right? And that's problematic for people, because people think in a whole different way. My relationship to God is there's me, there's God. And I understand God the way I understand you. And just as my relationship is to you and your relationship to me, I assume that that is the kind of relationship I have with God. I just blow it up a little bigger. Like infinitely. Okay? And so I just thought I'd take my own experience, project it upon my relationship to God, and blow it up. But that doesn't happen. Because our relationship is completely different than our relationship to God. God is the thinker, we are the thought. God is the knower, we are the
known.
We are the known. God is the subject, we are the object. And that's a completely different kind of relationship. Okay. So because of that, we have to appreciate the difficulties in trying to understand God. All right? Because the rules are different now. The way I understand everything else cannot be applied to the way I understand God. Okay? Let's understand the way we understand everything else. In general, when I think of something, when I think of this table, what's the relationship between myself and the table? If I'm thinking about this table, I'm examining this table, I want to get to know this table. Not so much, but I want to get to know this table. All right. So what is the nature of the relationship between myself and the table? I am the knower. I am the subject. And the table is the object. All right? The table is the object. All right. Very good. In addition, in order for me to know the table needs to be separate from me. Okay? And in fact, the table is. It's hard for me to know my eyes because in order for me to see the table must be separate from me. But I can't see my eyes because my eyes are not separate from me. So therefore, in the general process of knowing something, okay, there is a relationship between myself and it. I'm the subject, it's the object. I'm the knower, it's the known. And all that can happen because there is a separation between us. Following this? Good. In addition to that, not only in terms of my relationship to the table, but also in terms of the terminology I use in getting to know the table. What is the terminology that I use in order to get to know this table? How do I describe this table? What are the terms available to me? Only ones that I know, and the only ones that I know exist within time and space. In other words, all I can do with this table is describe it in terms of being here. Okay? I can describe it in terms of being now. And I can describe it in relationship to other beings that I know. I can say it's large. I can say it's small. But it's completely relative. Okay, there's a fantastic museum, which I don't even know where it is, but I heard about this museum, which is a museum which gives you a sense of the child's world. What does the world look like for a child? So you walk in there, and all of a sudden the table is up there. They built these huge furniture. So you should really understand what a child feels like. I don't know where this, does anyone know where this museum is?
You mean the children's Chicago?
Is it Chicago?
Yeah.
It's a fantastic idea. So you really understand what it means to be a child. It's really hard for a kid. You know, it's like when you're walking through a crowd, imagine what a kid's experiencing having to see everybody's knees. You know, like, you know, the world is a bunch of knees. And that's really very intimidating. Well, they don't realize it gets even more intimidating once you see their faces. But in the meantime, we walk into this museum and all of a sudden you realize a table. You know, imagine trying to get up on a chair. And you have to realize what it means to get up on a chair. It's all relative. This table might be big, right? If all I've ever experienced relative to is there's tables which are small. Okay? And it's really also relative. This situation I'm in might be very big, but that's very relative to maybe other experiences I've had in my life, which would make me understand that that was very small. And so therefore, the terminology that I have available to me to understand anything in the world is terminology based on time, space, and being. All right? So we just defined the normal process of thought. The normal process of thought, number one, is a function of relationships. Okay? And that relationship is subject, object. I am the subject. The table is the object. And that relationship is that there must be a separation between the two of us. Okay? For me to know it. The closer it gets to me, the harder it is for me to know it. It's got to be within the field of my vision and yet separate from me. So, normal thought is a function of relationship, subject-object, separation. Okay? Number two, normal thought is a terminology of time, space, being. Okay, so we've just defined normal thought. Now, we want to start thinking about God. And we have to see whether normal thought, as we've just discovered, is applicable to God. So now we have a big problem. A very big problem. In terms of relationship, relative to the table, I am the subject. I am the knower. The table is the object. The table is the known. Relative to God, I am the object. And God is the subject. Right? I'm trying to understand the table, right, in relation to God is like the table trying to understand me. That's a whole new thing. Do you follow that? That's a whole new problem. So in normal, when I'm thinking about a table, I'm the knower, the table is the known. But when I'm thinking about God, right, God's the knower, and I'm the known. So the relationship is inverted. So that's problem number one. The relationship is completely different. Right? Problem number two is when I'm thinking of the table is separate of me. Right? But when I'm thinking of God, God is not separate of me because He is the thinker and I am the thought. And I exist only as long as God continues to think of me. At the point that God forgets me, and please don't forget me, at that point, boom, my substance is gone. My substance is gone. So we now begin to see the problem with thinking about God. Once I've qualified the natural process of thought, I realize that it is totally inapplicable when I'm trying to get to know God. Because the rules of the game just don't fit. They don't work. Okay? So, problem number one, if normal thinking is a function of relationship, I subject, table, object, coming to know God, it's been inverted, I object, God subject. So, I now object, God is now the subject. Okay? Whereas the table is separate from me, I am not separate of God. So, the relationship is completely different. Number one. Number two, the terminology is completely inappropriate. Why is the terminology? Remember, what is the terminology we have available to us in getting to know what we know? What is the terminology available to us?
Everything about time and space.
Right? Time, space, being. Alright? But if time, space, being itself is made of idea, divine idea. Okay? So how can I now expect to take time, space, and being to define the source of time, space, being? Alright? People following us?
You said it again.
Yes. Basically, God cannot be known. The table can be known in terms of time, space, and being. It's here, it's now, it's large, it's small, it's skinny, it's fat, and it's all relative, based on its relationship compared to other being. Okay? It's now, it's here, it's small. But God cannot be known in terms of time, space, and being, which is the only vocabulary I have for knowing. Why can God be not known in terms of time, space, and being?
The idea. He's the creator.
Because he transcends time, space, and being. He is the source of time, space, and being. And therefore, how can I expect to stuff the source into the idea? How can I expect to stuff the thinker into the thought? So what we discovered is that our very process of knowledge and our very terminology of knowledge is completely inappropriate in coming to know the divine. Okay? And until a person is ready to let go of that, they will not get to really know what Judaism means when they say Hashem. Okay? Yes?
Are you familiar, you know Est? Remember Est? Do you know about that?
I know about it. Okay. I never did it.
I remember when I did it, 20 years ago, and yes, they said to me after they called us all idiots or whatever, you see that light? That's an illusion. You think it's a light, but it's not really a light. And then they talked about time, space, being. I had no clue what they were talking about. But isn't this exactly...
That's good. That's good. Now you're open to hear this.
But right. It's the same thing. That light is only an illusion based on what I know from time, space, my vocabulary, my reality. If my reality wasn't that light...
I wouldn't call it illusion. It's a function of the limitations of my perception. I wouldn't call it an illusion.
That's what they call...
Yeah, but I wouldn't. Right? But they make more money by doing it. The illusion is that they're going to really give you something, and you're really going to get something. I don't know.
Forget the word.
You should tell them that, by the way, the check I wrote you was also an illusion. It's going to bounce. I don't have to tell you. I'm not saying it's an illusion. It's a perception. Let me tell you what the Zohar says. The Zohar says that when Jacob was on his way down to Egypt, God says to Jacob, "Don't worry, Joseph will close your eyes." Oh, now I feel much better. But what does that mean? So the Zohar says that Jacob was just told that he will die in Egypt. However, Joseph will close his eyes. Jewish law says that when a person dies, you have to close their eyes. Okay? So if they die and their eyes are open, then you have a responsibility to close those eyes. So the Zohar asks why. So the Zohar answers, because the shapes, the forms, the texture, the colors of this world are in your eyes. And in order to see the next world, you must close the eyes so they can now see the next world. Mind-boggling, right? But does that mean that it's an illusion? No, it's a perception. And there's value to your perception. But recognize your perception is still relative. And thank God it's relative, because that means there's hope for another level of perception. Okay? But I wouldn't want to use the word illusion. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't certain things that Judaism does claim to be an illusion. Okay, one of the things that Judaism says is an illusion is, in fact, separateness. That the entire universe is organically connected and nothing has isolated reality. That, if you think something has an isolated reality, that is a lie. That is an illusion. Okay, and that's what you have to be aware of and cautious of. Not separating things into separate, independent pieces. Because all of reality is interdependent, according to Judaism. However, the normal process of thought, which is a function of relationship, separation, I-subject, table object, that is no longer applicable when I try to know God. The relationship has been inverted, and the separation has in fact been collapsed. Okay? The separation has been collapsed. The sense of distance is no longer possible. Okay? In terms of the terminology I have for perception is time, space, being, and that's what I do to apply to understand you and everything else, but when I try to understand God, who is the source of time, space, being itself being an idea of the divine, the idea cannot define the thinker, but the idea can reflect the thinker. And so, the next step of this little exercise is so we want to now talk about the ways of knowing God. We have just discovered that our general way of knowing something is inapplicable vis-a-vis trying to know the divine. But then what are the ways of knowing the divine? Now someone had a question. I saw a hand go up. Yes.
And trying to get a perspective, as you said this last time, on how, if we're the thought of God, we're the thought of God thinking about God thinking about us. I mean, the reason we exist is God's thinking.
Frank, did you ever take drugs? I'm just joking.
I mean, I'm trying to get a perspective on it. So, how do you explain how can you get a handle on the idea that we have consciousness?
Frank, you're going too fast.
Okay.
I don't think as fast as you. I'm sorry. We're going too fast. Just hold on to that question, okay? In fact, I wanted to bring in a picture that Escher did, which will kind of give you a sense of what this is, okay? Escher, you know? Oh, it's a picture of a man in a gallery looking at a picture of himself in a gallery. It's quite a remarkable kind of experience. But you're going a step that I don't want to talk about yet. But we're going to get to it, okay? And I appreciate you reminding me of it. Yes?
Okay, so given that we have inappropriate terminology and that we're not separate and we're the object trying to understand the subject, so
right,
all the reverse of what we do here, how are our relationship with other people a model and supposed to teach us how to relate to God?
Ah, that's exactly the next step. Ways of knowing God. The ways of knowing God is a totally new approach. Right? We need a new approach, which we'll discover is actually not so new, right? But a new approach. What's the new approach? First of all, the new approach, actually we need two things. We need a new approach, and we need to accept the limitations even of that new approach. Okay? And if we don't accept the limitations, we're just going to torment ourselves. Okay? Just know what you can expect to get. Right? And if you're open, you know, you can't always get what you want. We've tried sometimes. You get what you need. And that was the saying of some great Hasidic Rebbe. I know this guy had a following, I just can't place it. Okay, Moshe Jagger, right. Moshe Jagger. All right. Moshele. The Halakha Moshele. Okay. Now, let's think about this. The new approach goes like this. I cannot know God as an object of thought, right? But I can know God as the subject of all thought. Okay? And that's the point. I cannot think of God as an object, but I can experience God as the subject. And that's going to be the difference. I cannot commit God to thought, but I can open myself to a sense, to an experience. And therefore, what we're talking about here is the difference between thought versus intuition. And is there room to intuition? I intuit.
What you just said, can you repeat the whole thing?
No problem, it's in my notes. Okay.
Lucky for you.
Lucky for me, it's in my notes over here. Alright. I cannot know God, alright, as an object of thought. But I can know God as the subject of all thought. Alright. I cannot, so to speak, see God over there. But I can experience God at the very source and as the very context of the process of thinking itself, the process of being itself. I cannot think of God as an object, but I can experience God as the subject of all thought, the source of all wisdom. I can experience a source. You've had that experience, okay? We talked about it the other day. The experience, for instance, of someone doing public lectures, right? Who forgets his notes, okay? And sometimes you get into a role where you yourself don't know where this is coming from, right? I've had the experience where people ask me a question and I do not know the answer. And I feel real dumb. And at that moment, my ego says, but give one anyways. Or maybe it's my soul. But what happens is uncontrollably, I just begin to talk and I'm just as new to hearing this as you are. And I just sometimes go, that's a great answer, wasn't it? But if you do that, they think you're nuts. So you pretend like you really gave that answer. But you experience that somehow you've just been a vehicle for a greater subject, right? And that somehow you're participating in expressing that greater subject. That is the experience we talked about yesterday about the artist who sits there and is completely dumbfounded because although he looks at all the works of art that he has done throughout the years, once again, as he's about to approach this painting, this new painting, he feels completely inadequate. He feels, I cannot do this. But with perfect faith, somehow, he puts his paintbrush into the paint and makes a line, and then somehow he experiences being the paintbrush. He experiences a greater subject, right? And that he himself is part of this painting. And that's a remarkable experience.
And what is
this line
his name?
Pardon? Yeah. And that we will talk about, because he falls into ego. But a true artist will look at his painting with such objectivity, with such appreciation, he will have the equal ability to look at that painting and say, this is incredible, without taking it personally. He will be able to say, this is awesome, right, and feel totally uncomfortable in writing his name to it. Because how could I write my name to it? Is it truly my work of art? Or have I been somehow blessed to be a vehicle? Have I somehow been blessed to bring this into the world? That's why when you say something to somebody, if someone comes up to me and say, wow, that was a great class, which generally people don't, but if someone comes up to me and says, that was a great class, then what you say is, Baruch Hashem, which does not mean thank God, but rather means God is the source of all blessing, right? And I'm just so gratified that I had a part in that. I could participate in the creative expression of God in the world. That's what Baruch Hashem, if you write a song, right, you really experience, my gosh, where did that come from? I've had the experience writing songs where literally all I was trying to do was get out of the way. That was really the work, is just get out of the way. And I remember sitting there on my piano and just doing think, 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 and somehow I really literally feel somehow possessed and moved, and my fingers know exactly where to go. And I remember one song I wrote, my wife walked out from the bedroom I was in, the living room where the piano was, and she walks out, she says, what is that? What is that? And I said, I don't know. I don't know. But I'm just trying not to interfere. You know, I'm just trying not to interfere. That we've experienced that. We've experienced the subject of ourselves, which is beyond ourselves. A much greater subject. And so I cannot know God as an object of thought, but I can experience God as the subject of my thoughts, the subject of my creativity, the subject of my very being. And that's an experience. That's something one intuits. That's something one encounters. That's something one can feel. But then they can't express it in words, because once again, how do you express this with the mere, meager terminology I have of time, space, being? And that's very difficult. They once asked Dylan, how do you write music? And he said, I just put my pen on the paper and I know it's going to be all right. Now go to school and learn that. Right? You know, how do you go to school and learn how to put your pen on the paper and know it's going to be all right? All right. Or they asked the famous director, so famous I forgot his name, Ingmar Bergman, is that his name? They said, how do you make films? He said, I don't make films. Films make me. He said, I don't direct films. I let the film tell me. What is this experience of a greater subject that I'm really a receptacle of? You know? So, we need a whole new approach. ways of knowing God, not by committing to thought, but by opening myself up to sense, opening myself up to intuition, opening myself up to experience. I cannot define God in terms of time, space, and being, but I can experience God as reflected in time, space, and being. Because the master is reflected in his masterpiece. I would never think that that picture over there has captured the essence of the artist, but it's certainly a reflection of who that guy is, you know? Or when I hear an artist sing his song, I would never ever think that that song defines who he is, but I would never say that his spirit isn't also in his song, but not confined to his song, and thereby cannot be defined by his song. But certainly, he is reflected in his song. Alright? So if I were a finger and I was trying to get to know the entire body which I am merely a small part of, how would I get to know the body that I am part of? So true, the body is reflected to its own relativity within the finger, but again, it would only be a reflection. So therefore, how can I know God? So I cannot define God in terms of time, space, and being, but I can experience God as God is reflected in His ideas. God is reflected in time, space, being. I can experience God as God is reflected in me. Okay? And the more I know myself, the more I come to know God, although I am not God. Okay? And that is a different way. That's why it says in the book of Job, it says, through my flesh I will envision God. By reflecting upon my own being, somehow I will come to know God. Therefore, how does one come to know God? It's really by making the world and myself into a mirror of God. Or actually a mirror for God. And that's a very, very profound experience. People who are locked into thought, right, will have a hard time with it. The reason why they're having a hard time with it is because you're being asked to accept new rules vis-a-vis this particular topic. Okay? Not to in any way diminish the importance of thought. The rules of thought should be applied to the world of objects. But the rules of thought cannot be applied to the world of the ultimate absolute subject, who relative to, we are really idea. We are really object. So, I come to know God by acknowledging myself, or actually by experiencing myself as being known by God. Experiencing myself as being acknowledged. And a sense of being confirmed in my reality. That remarkable sense that, yes, I am of significance, but to whom? Right? And that was what the example I gave the other day. It's when you were a little child, you ran away, you're so angry at your parents, right? But you ran away hoping someone would come looking for you, but there you are sitting really in the backyard waiting. Gee, nobody's coming to look for me. Gee, there's nothing more horrifying than feeling that you don't make a difference in this universe, that you really don't matter, that you are not acknowledged. And yet the religious experience is in fact an experience of being acknowledged, right? Being acknowledged, being known. The religious experience is not trying to see God, but experience being seen by God. And you know what it means to be seen, right? You've been on a bus, and all of a sudden you turn around and, whoop, guy turns his head. You know this person was looking at you. You know what it means to feel like you've been looked at. And yet on one hand, you don't want this strange person looking at you, but you do want somebody to be looking at you, right? Because you want to be acknowledged, because that's basically the essence of your reality. Your reality is acknowledgement. So it is only natural that you seek to be acknowledged. The question is, by whom? Right? And whom would give you that eternal acknowledgement? Right? And so, knowing God means experiencing myself as the known, feeling acknowledged by a reality beyond myself. Feeling that somehow I'm important in the eyes of reality beyond myself. And I remember I was walking down Manhattan, And I'm not from Manhattan, from a small town called Toronto, but still Manhattan is, for me, a very intimidating place. And I'm walking in the center of Manhattan, and all of a sudden I'm looking up and I'm seeing how tall these skyscrapers are and how many people are here. And it was really threatening. All of a sudden I realized, I'm nothing in Manhattan. I'm really nothing in Manhattan. This is, you know, it was really frightening. And then I got to the corner of a street ready to cross. The light turns red. And then a group of people start bunching up and crowding up because they're also waiting to cross the street because the light turned red. And I'm feeling more squished and more compressed and more compressed. At that moment, I lost it. I felt like I'm just a fiber in a big blob of Manhattan, you know, in the melting pot or in a melting flesh pot. That's what I felt like. And then the light turned green and the blob of Manhattan began to move. And I was merely being carried in its blobhood. Right? And as we're going and I'm just like losing it, my whole sense of being seen, my whole sense of being acknowledged, the feeling really of matter, right, was gone. And at that moment when I felt I was nothing, I saw a telephone pole, one of the million of telephone poles in Manhattan, and on this pole was this little flyer. And I stopped, something told me to look at this flyer, something or someone told me to look at this flyer, and I'm looking at this flyer, and I start to read it, and it's this almost unreadable scrawl, and it says, "Come to the Coco Cafe and hear the greatest guitar player in the world. Be there or be square." That was it, man. I mean, I was ready to be a nothing, but a square nothing was just too much. I just thought, that's just too much. And I looked at, and I thought, what chutzpah. What absolute chutzpah. Everyone knows what that means, right? That is just a jerk. I mean, how can you write that? And a mere piece of paper, a worthless piece of paper with your worthless looking writing that I could hardly even read, and I'm sorry I even tried, and it's on one pole of the million poles, and you're telling everybody you know us, the greatest guitar player in the world, playing in some dump, you know, that never heard of, and I'm a square, right? I'm a square. And that's remarkable. It's remarkable that a person still believes that they can be acknowledged. They still believe that it's possible that somehow, although everything from without tells me I'm nothing, something from within says, you're really something. Who is telling me that I'm really something? Who is acknowledging my existence? And I was really thinking about that as I'm walking down Manhattan. And I realized, I said to myself, you know what? What really matters, David, is not what people think of you, but what God thinks of you. What the transcendental reality sees in you, not what you're trying to see from others. And so I had this realization in Manhattan, just to prove to you that you can have a realization in Manhattan. And it's not from the fumes of the cars. So to experience myself as known, as seen, as acknowledged, to realize my need to be known and to be seen and to be acknowledged, and yet from a perspective of a beyond, right? That's what it means to begin to sense God in one's life. Also, to see Hashem, the divine, to the extent that the divine is reflected in the tree, right? To the extent that the divine is reflected in the flowers, in the children, to the extent. Because the divine is reflected, because the world is a masterpiece. That's how Judaism would say it. And so therefore, everything is a piece of the master. But not literally a piece of the master, but a piece of the master is reflected in this incredible work. And so, knowing God means allowing the world to become the mirror for the divine. It means not trying to think about God, but to reflect upon myself, to reflect upon the world. In addition, knowing God means, in Judaism, emunah. What is emunah? Emunah is generally translated as faith. Okay, generally translated faith. That is, unfortunately, that's unfortunate that it's being translated that way. Because generally people think faith is, you know, it's blind, right? Because it's contrary to rational thought. That's what generally people think. The problem is, well, when you come down to thought, you can't approach the divine with the mechanism called thought for the reasons we have described, the inversion of relationship, the lack of separation and space for comprehension, and the complete inappropriateness to the very vocabulary we're trying to use. All right? So the truth is, yes, emunah is not rational thought, but that doesn't mean it's less than rational thought. Emunah is understood to be higher than rational thought. Right? It's so high, that's why it cannot be committed to the mere terminology that I use. And what I'm exploring is so different from everything else I've ever explored, I cannot expect the regular, you know, regular mode of thought to accomplish that. So emunah, which is generally translated as faith, is generally seen in people's eyes as something below, right? And something that is disrespected. However, that's not what emunah really means. Emunah for the Jewish people is higher than rational thought. Because it's trying to explore the divine, and it's a new way. It's called emunah. Alright? What does emunah literally mean? Well, generally emunah is understood to be faith and described in, you know, certain statements I say. Right? I believe this about God, I believe that about God, and it's a number of statements. But emunah, or the ish or isha of emunah, a person, a believing person, a person who has emunah, is not a person who's able to articulate in a very grandiose way some philosophical understanding of the divine. That is not a person of faith. Okay? I'm not saying that might not be, a person of faith might not be able to do that or try to do that, but that's not the essence, that's not what emunah is. Emunah comes from the word ne'emanut. Right, it's connected to two words, ne'emanut and omanut. Ne'emanut means, anyone know what ne'emanut means? Right? Trustworthy, it means devotion. Ne'emanut is devotion. Therefore, when we say an ish emunah, which would be translated as a person of faith, that would not be an accurate translation. Rather, ish emunah would be a person of devotion. Right? That's what emunah is. I am devoted to my ultimate subject, who I am an expression of, who I am a manifestation of. I, as the idea, am committed to the thinker. And I better be, because if I'm not, I'm just basically cutting myself off from the very source of my existence. Right? It is a natural sense of draw to my source, to my ground, all right, to my context. And ish emunah is a person who is ne'eman to their thinker, so to speak, to the source. It also is connected to the word omanut. Does anyone know what omanut means? Art. An oman is an artist. An artist has the ability to portray the abstract. In other words, an artist wants to paint a picture of love. So they have this ability to paint that picture. They have the ability to translate, to envision, and to represent in the language that they have of art, that which is beyond that which they are trying to convey. You follow this? Very important. An artist is a master of portrayal. A master of portrayal. What is an ish emunah? An ish emunah is an artist. An ish emunah is a person who has the ability to portray God in the world. How? Through their speech, through their actions, through their lifestyle, through their relationship with other people. When people meet them, they confirm their sense that there is a one reality, right? There is a director to this show that we are part of. A ish emunah is a person who successfully portrays God. I am created in the image of God. The idea is a reflection of the thinker. I am the idea of God par excellence, created in the image of God. I am created with the potential to reflect the divine. And ish emunah is a person who in fact does that. I meet God when I meet a holy person. Not that they are God, but they are a mirror. They are a reflection. When I meet them, they confirm that inner intuition. Yes, there is a subject to all of what's going on. Yes, there is a thinker. Yes, there is direction. Yes, there is meaning. Yes, I have been known. Yes, I have been acknowledged. Yeah.
Where's the word amen?
Amen fits exactly into that. Because when a person says a bracha and you say amen, which is connected to emunah, you are basically saying, right on, I vote for that. I am dedicated to that very same idea. All right? Also, amen is connected to the word emet. Well, what is emet? It's the ability to portray that which is beyond. A person who can speak truth is able to formulate as best as words can go something that would allude to the divine, but certainly not confine or define the divine. And so emunah, and ish emunah, is a person who successfully, I come to know God by portraying God in the world. Right? The question I have to ask myself when I walk into a store to buy a car is, well, you know, so to speak, how would God buy this car? Right? Would God make a fool of himself and start, you know, asking for all kinds of crazy things? Right? Or, you know, or when I'm in a business deal, I have to ask myself, listen, I'm responsible to portray divinity, to give people that sense also of their being acknowledged. And if I don't acknowledge them, then in that way is my crime. In that way, my relationship, my responsibility to human being is also damaging their relationship or their sense of God. So that's why in Judaism, the laws between a human being and human being are intimately connected to the laws between mankind and God. They are interconnected also. The way I relate to you and acknowledge you, and the way I allow you to relate to me or acknowledge me, is itself something that reflects God. So how do I get to know God? Through our relationships. Because in our relationship is reflected, but it's only a reflection. It still doesn't capture, but it is a reflection. Yes?
I don't understand if we're all thoughts of God, how an ishamana is any more a reflection of God than someone evil.
Oh, okay. And that comes down to, which we're not going to do today, which is, what is God thinking about you? Okay? So to speak, again, we're stuck in these words because even the word thought is a time space and it's something we know about with beings, but that's the word we got, so we acknowledge this limitation. But when I'm thinking of somebody in my mind, okay, I cannot imagine a free person. Because the only person I can imagine is the person who will be doing what I think them to be doing. The mystery of the divine, okay, beyond logic, paradoxically, is God is thinking of a free being. When God, so to speak, thought of the table, he did not think of a free being, and therefore it is not a free being. But when God thought of a free being, a being of free choice, he thought of man. And this is a mystery, okay? To the extent that I have free choice, to that extent I reflect God. To the extent that I take that free choice and do very sick and crazy things, things that do not portray the divine, to that extent I conceal the divine in the world, for others and for myself. But this is a mystery. I mean, you know, as I've mentioned, we cannot completely hope. We cannot hope to understand the divine in the regular way we understand things. We can only sense. We sense our freedom, and yet we also sense our destiny. And those two are very real feelings in our lives. Okay? So, mitzvot, according to Judaism, how would that then fit into this whole scheme? A mitzvah is essentially a pattern of life, a commandment, so to speak, is a kind of behavioral pattern which is a portrayal of the divine. Okay? A sin, therefore, would be a betrayal of the divine. The choice is to portray God or to betray God. That is the choice. And so am I living in a way, when I walk down the street and I see an old person and he's all beat up and he's got no money, I see that person and I just, at that moment, it's clear to me the right way, what it would, you know, it reflecting divinity in the world, the obvious thing to do is I reach into my pocket and I hand this person tzedakah, I hand this person charity, right? And that was a portrayal of God, okay? But if I walk down the street and I see this poor person, and God forbid I kick this person, that would not be a scene that would reflect that we are all one reality, right? So to speak, unified as the expression of divine thought. And that would be horrible. And I have betrayed not only God, but also who I am and who I could become. And so it's a very different kind of understanding of what a mitzvah is. Because very often people think a mitzvah is a good boy point. You know, a girl guide, you know. It's much deeper than that. It's living a lifestyle that is reflective of the divine. Reflective of an experience of being known. Reflective of the experience of appreciating that all human beings should feel acknowledged and known. And that is really what mitzvot are. The Arizal, Rav Isaac Luria, who was a very great Kabbalist, he had a technique in diagnosing people. Remarkable. He would ask people who were not well would come to him for a diagnosis. He would ask people to close their eyes, which I will now ask you to do. Close your eyes. He would ask them to envision the name of God. The Yud, the He, the Vav, the He. Just bring that into focus. Imagine that name. Envision that name. Now, I want you to keep your eyes closed. It's okay. I want you to describe for me what it looks like. Is there any letters in the name of God that you're having a hard time focusing on? Okay, what letter can't you see?
Well, the hay is really standing out. I'm having trouble, especially with the yud.
You're having troubles with the yud. Okay. Do you have any letters that you're having problems getting into focus over here?
Initially, it was with the vav.
You had a problem with the vav.
The hays are harder for me.
The hays are harder.
Well, it's kind of like this fire around the entire thing, and each letter is sort of, it becomes clear and then unclear.
Wow. All right, good. Let's do something else now. I want you to see the colors of it.
I see white fuzz. It's out. It's got other like colors, like derivatives of red, yellow, orange on the outside, but it's very fuzzy and white.
Go ahead. Just start calling it out.
White against gray.
White against gray. What? We got a purple.
Is it translucent?
Translucent. Ooh. The colors are the
northern lights.
Wow, the northern lights.
What are colors?
Let's go on.
Red.
Red.
I get ivy. It's all green. There's ivy growing all around the letters.
Ivy growing around the letters. Whoa. Whoa. Wait till I tell the Arizal what you guys saw. Okay, you can open your eyes. The Arizal, based on the letters or the portions of letters, the colors, would diagnose exactly what mitzvah, what commandment this person is being neglectful of, right? And they would basically just be more concerned with doing that mitzvah and they would be healed. That is the tradition we have about the Arizal. Now, what has one got to do with the other? What does my ability to envision the name of God have to do with my health? Wow! Right? What does it have to do with my health? My ability to envision God is somewhat reflective of my connectedness to my thinker. Right? God envisioning me will be reflected in my ability to envision His name because I am, so to speak, a living vision of the divine, so to speak. A image of the divine. An idea of the divine. And I, as the idea, trying to let that thought emerge even more, depends on how much am I screening it out. Right? To the extent that I'm kind of getting in the way and not letting that expression happen, to the extent that that yud, hey, vav, hey, will be either stained by a different color or there'll be certain letters missing. And that is really remarkable. That is really remarkable. It's like our relationship to God is like the relation between the film and the light of the camera, so to speak, which is going through that film. It's animating, right? And it's, so to speak, that light of consciousness, of divinity, that is animating, is first giving me reality and animating my reality. But the mystery of the paradox of it is that the character that God is thinking of, you and me, is a free character with free choice. Okay.
Are you
going to
tell us what it all means?
Yeah.
Costs much more. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. I don't know. I wish I knew. I'd be a millionaire by now. You know, gee, if you could do that, my gosh. I mean, we have lost. We have lost. By the way, you know what else the Ari could do? Rav Isaac Lurier, right? Rav Isaac Lurier had the ability to see on the forehead of his students a verse from the Torah. Every day, there is a different verse on your forehead. Okay? It doesn't come off with water. Okay? Different verse on your forehead. The Ari had the ability to look at all his students and see what that verse was on their forehead. He would teach them the secret of the first half of the verse. And then they would go to sleep and they would wake up knowing the other half of the verse. All right? Now what does that mean, that there's a verse on everybody's forehead? All right? What I believe it means is, once again, every single day I am a living verse, a living expression of a divine truth. The question I have today, will I fulfill my day? Will I today come into the world and through my behavior and through my realizations and through my struggles truly fulfill and portray in a living manner the meaning of that verse? Right? Or will I somehow think today was a totally different verse? Or perhaps I see written on my forehead a verse from the Rolling Stones. You know what I mean? That's the question. What is it? And so this is how the true Torah Jew experiences their life. They experience their life as a divine idea. They experience their responsibility as fulfilling and portraying that idea in its most brilliant form. Right? And they treat other people as reflections of the divine. They treat animals, they treat everything as somewhat of a reflection of divinity. And that is what would change the person. Okay, now I would like you to turn to that article that we did, so that I think it will come more into focus. And with this, we will have ended this part of reality and perception, and we will then have the opportunity to go to the next part, which will be, I need to discover with you the psychological implications these ideas have in everyday life on a practical level, of how do I then improve my life based on these metaphysical backdrops. Okay, and that's what we're going to work towards. He is the knower, and we are the known. That to be means to be thought of by Him. Okay. Thinking of God is made possible by His being the subject, and by our being His object. Okay? That's what it means to think about God, really. Right? Not the normal way we think, but when we talk about thinking about God, what we're really thinking about is being the object of a greater subject, being the character in the mind of the great mastermind, the divine. To think of God is to expose ourselves to Him. To think of God is to conceive ourselves as a reflection of His reality. That's what it means to think of God. To think of God is to experience myself as a reflection of God. That's what you want to do when you talk about to think about God. It's not what we mean when we talk about thinking about that table. When Judaism talks about thinking about God, completely different idea. He cannot be limited to a thought. Why can he not be limited to a thought? Because he is the source of all thought. Right? So how can God be limited to a thought? Okay? To think means to set aside or to separate an object from the thinking subject. When I think about the table, I must create a distance. I am creating that distance by virtue of thinking of it. But in setting him apart, in trying to think about God in the normative way, by setting him apart, we gain an idea and lose him. Right? The philosopher, in trying to think about God, loses God. in the process of thinking about God, by trying to make God into an object rather than experience God as the subject of his very process of thinking. Right? Okay. So, since he is not away from us, and we are not beyond him, okay? In other words, God is closer to you than your very eyeballs, right? God is closer to you than, you know, as close as yourself is to you, and yet they're not synonymous. Since he is not away from us and we are not beyond him, he can never become the mere object of our thought. So forget about thinking about God the way you generally think about other things. All right? And that is the beginning of coming close to the divine. The problem that people have is they walk into an experience like a Jewish learning and they apply the regular rules that they've been applying, very successful in understanding everything else in their life. Right? And then when you try to talk about the divine, they just don't follow you. Why? Because once again, they're trying to apply a way of thinking which is completely inappropriate. And so therefore, as in thinking about ourselves, the object cannot be detached from the subject, right? I'm thinking about myself. So I, which is the subject, is thinking about myself, which is the object. And that itself is a mystery. How can I be both the subject and the object of the sentence? And that itself is a mystery that we're going to be talking about in the upcoming classes, the idea of self-transcendence. Okay? But for now, as in thinking about ourselves, the object cannot be detached from the subject. So in thinking of God, the subject cannot be detached from the object. When I think about myself, I am the subject, myself is the object, and the object cannot be detached from the subject. When I think about God, in essence, I am the object, and God is the subject, right? And they cannot be separated either. Okay, the thought can't be separated from the thinker, and so therefore, in thinking of Him, we realize that it is through Him that we think of Him, and this is what Frank was way ahead of us all alluding to. So my attempt to think about God is actually breaking into a process of God's own thinking of himself. Wow, right? That's what it means to think about God, to break into this divine circuit of self-thought, divine thought of self, right? God reflecting upon himself, and I am breaking into that process. I feel that somehow I've been allowed to participate in God knowing himself. And I'm just kind of plugging into that. All right.
So are we teaching God? Are we showing him? I still am not aware of the function.
You're right, because I haven't talked about it. And that, I have to tell you the truth, is going to be in the next 3 weeks to get to why is this happening. All right? But that's, there's just so much that I have to build up to be able to get to that. And that's the way it goes. Okay, so in thinking of Him, we realize that it's through Him that we think of Him. So when I'm trying to think about God, what I'm actually doing is sharing, and so to speak, God's thinking of Himself. Right? In thinking of Him, we realize that it's through Him that we think of Him. Thus, we must think of Him as the subject of all, as the life of our life, as the mind of our mind. And that's an incredible experience. And I've had that experience, and I bet you have too, in your life, but the question is being able to focus it, get in touch with it. Okay. If an idea had ability, and here he's really very strong, if an idea had ability to think and transcend itself, in other words, I'm thinking of a man right now in my mind. I've just created him, okay? And now that man in my mind, if I endow him with the ability to think, right, which I can't, but in this scenario, God can, okay? It would be aware of its being at this moment, a thought of my mind. Wow! Imagine that experience. Mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. There's a fantastic book, short story by Kurt Vonnegut. It's a short story about an author who decides to introduce himself to his character, the figment of his imagination. So he decides to, so to speak, write himself into his story, right? You really wonder what these people have been taking. I mean, it's really bizarre. It's unbelievable. And so the author has written this character. And the character, I don't remember the exact details of the story, but the character is sitting in a bar. And the author walks into the bar. Right? Martha walks into the bar. And the guy looks at him, and the author is really looking at him with eyes of just total knowing. Right? Like, you know, you've ever had that experience, you walk in the street, and someone looks at you, and you know they know you, but you don't know who they are. And they say, oh, how are you? And you know that you are completely familiar to them, but you don't know who they are. So this guy sitting in the bar looks at this stranger walks in the bar, and the stranger is looking at him with eyes of such familiarity, he can't understand what's going on. So he says, hey, buddy, what's it to you? I mean, who are you? So he looks at him and says, don't you know who I am? He says, no. So he takes out of his pocket his pen. Says, I wrote you. I wrote you. Yes, yes. You are the expression of my imagination. You are the expression of my creativity. I wrote you. I wrote you sitting in this bar. I wrote you sitting on that bench. I wrote you drinking that martini. Well, the guy freaks out. He can't take it. What? You're crazy! And he runs out of the bar, you know, and he's running down the street, now he's sitting, you know, in a park underneath a tree, and he's saying, gee, glad I got rid of that nut. What a sick guy! You know, imagine, thinking I'm an object, and he's the subject. Imagine thinking that I am merely the expression of his own creativity. But of course, this guy starts walking down the street, right? And there he sees him waving his pen. Hey, buddy. Hello. I wrote you under that tree. In fact, I'm going to right now write an apple fall on your head. Or maybe even a bird do something on your head. Until you get the point. Right? And I'm embellishing. I'm sure Kurt Vonnegut will not appreciate this. But he didn't write me. Okay. It's a shame. I would have been better. Okay. Now, God wrote me. All right, I think. So, this is a remarkable experience that the character cannot deal with because it undermines everything he wanted to believe about himself. But if he would just be open to it, he would find his true home. He would find his true source. He would experience, right, that incredible connection to the transcendental subject beyond himself. If an idea had ability to think and to transcend itself, it would be aware of its being at this moment a thought of my mind. The religious man has such an awareness of being known by God, as if he were an object, a thought in his, the divine mind. To the philosopher, God is an object. To men at prayer, God is the subject. Okay? Their aim is not to possess, the man at prayer, is not to possess him as a concept of knowledge, to be informed about him, as if he were a fact among facts. What they, the person at prayer, crave for is to be wholly possessed by him, to be an object of his knowledge and to sense that. That was the sense that David HaMelech had when he said, Ani tefilati, I am my prayer. And that is what a person can experience when they're praying, just as we've talked about the experience of the painter, experiencing that they are not the painter, but in fact they themselves are part of the painting, and that there's a greater painter. So to a person at prayer, when you really succeed in prayer, what does it mean to get your prayer answered? How will you know your prayer was answered? When you experience that you have become the prayer, and that these words are pouring out of you, right, as an expression of the greater subject, and that the greater mind, which your mind is a spark of, okay, is somehow being reflected and channeled through your mind. Okay, let's now go to the next page over here on the bottom over here. Bottom of that article. His knowledge of man precedes man's knowledge of him, right? While man's knowledge of him, the divine, comprehends only what God asks of man. And so, back to ways of knowing God. Ways of knowing God, meaning God, is intuition, sensing, experiencing, seeing the reflection of the divine in all of reality, in time, space, and being. Seeing the reflection of God in the face of every human being. Seeing the reflection of God in your own face. Okay? Knowing God means emunah, successfully portraying the meaning of being a divine thought, the meaning of being a divine image. Okay? And knowing God is also through revelation, which we're going to be dealing with, which is knowing the divine will. I might not be able to know what God, who God is, because it won't fit into the categories of normative thought. But what I can know is how God envisions me, what God wants from me. And that is the essence of prophecy. The essence of prophecy is not coming to know about God, the essence of God. No. The essence of prophecy is coming to know the will. What did this author have in mind for me, his character? And how can I fulfill and be that ultimate reflection of my author? And so therefore we go on. God's vision of man. The Bible is primarily not man's vision of God, but God's vision of man. When I read the Bible, I'm not trying to figure out what God looks like, right? To me, I'm trying to figure out what I should look like to God, right? And that's what the Torah is all about. When I'm reading the Torah, I'm not talking about God. I'm talking about Abraham. What a masterpiece, Abraham. What an incredible reflection of divinity. So much so that I've come to know the God of Abraham. I have come to know God because of my great-great Zadie Abraham and what he has reflected about divine truth, about kindness. And what I know about God is what I know about Isaac. How Isaac reflects the attribute of Gevurah, of power. And what Jacob reflects about the attribute of beauty and truth. That's how I know God. By meeting holy people. People who have succeeded in truly being in the image of God. People who have succeeded in modeling themselves according to the vision that God has for mankind. And therefore the Bible is primarily not man's vision of God, but God's vision of man. The Bible is not man's theology, but God's anthropology. Dealing with man and what he asks of him rather than the nature of God. When I study Torah, what do I want to know? The Torah is not going to tell me the nature of God. But the Torah is going to tell me what God asks of me. Right? And what God asks of me is to be that perfect image. Right? To be the character he envisioned me to be. And yet, to be free. He envisioned me to be a free character. Free to reflect the image of God. That's what God, so to speak, envisioned me being. Okay. God did not reveal to the prophets eternal mysteries, but his knowledge and love of man. That's what God told the prophets. The prophets were told, so to speak, were guaranteed that God hasn't forgotten man. And that divine loves. The author loves his character. The author loves his character. It was not the aspiration of Israel to know the absolute. That's not what Israel has been trying to do, to know the absolute. But to ascertain what he asks of man. To commune with his will rather than with his essence. His essence? Forget about it. But I can know God's will. Okay? Through revelation, also through intuition. Okay? And we'll be talking about the relationship between that. In the depth of our trembling, all that we can utter is the awareness of our being known to God. That's all we can say, is I feel that I am acknowledged. I feel that I am meaningful. But to who? To who? And I can't define the who, but I can experience. Man cannot see God, but man can be seen by God. He is not the object, God is not the object of a discovery, but the subject of revelation. Right? And if I'm trying to discover God, I will only find an idea. I will not meet my master, my author. Okay. We do not have to express God when we let ourselves continue to be His, the echo of His expression. I'm not trying to express God. I don't need to say anything about God in terms of words. But what I need to do is to portray God in terms of the way I live my life. And that is the true person of faith. Now let's look again at Rav Kook's Light of Holiness. But we will only look at this paragraph. Okay? The vital quality in Ein Sof, the Ein Sof is the mystical term for the divine, the endless one. The endless one. Right? The vital quality in Ein Sof is divine intelligence. What's the vital quality of the divine? Divine intelligence. All that flows from its spirit. The more it is connected to the divine source, the stronger the living link between them will be. Okay. Anything that flows from the divine intelligence, which I have somehow been allowed to be a participant in, right? To be a participant in, the more it's connected to the divine source, the stronger the living link between them. In other words, the living link between that which exists and the source is this intelligence, and the stronger and the clearer the intelligence. Okay. And those truly devoted to God thus feel the vigor of their lives in divine thought. That was the key sentence I wanted you to see. Those who devoted to God, what does devoted mean? The word is emunah. Thus feel vigor of their lives. But what is the feeling of the vigor of their lives? The vigor of their lives is in divine thought. When experiences themselves in divine thought, they have tapped the very vigor of their lives. Therefore, Rav Kook brings in a verse, it is this vigor of life that strengthens, refining, and instilling supreme happiness. Supreme happiness to really discover who we are. And I will rejoice in the Lord. When I put myself back into the genuine context of life, when I put my mind back into the divine mind, when I put myself, the idea, back into the divine thinker, that is when I begin to rejoice. Alright? And we'll just finish off with this last paragraph here of Rav Kook. As for the divine, everything already exists in reality. What I believe Rav Kook is already hinting over here is what Einstein dealt with in terms of the time-space continuum. Is the future already in existence? And of course, then the question becomes free choice, which we're going to have to work on. Okay? As for the divine, everything already exists in reality. For all that was, is, and will be, all is in his spirit. All that was, is, will be, is already within the spirit, knowledge, and desire of the divine. It is a basic principle that divine knowledge encompasses what is in reality, because there is nothing outside of reality as far as God is concerned. Moreover, it is irrelevant to speak of God's knowledge encompassing what is not part of reality, for his knowledge encompasses all. He is inherent in the most excellent aspects of reality. The thinker is inherent in his thought, but he is not confined to his thought. The thinker is inherent in his thought while remaining transcendent of his thought. And the entirety of earthly realities are no more than tiny sparks in the light of that supernal reality.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.